From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today, what's the latest in being able to buy coverage on healthcare.gov?
Well, if you're someone who's looking for insurance for the first time and creating an account right now at healthcare.gov, it's working tremendously better.
We'll talk with one of Michigan's ACA navigators. Plus, the leader of the petition drive for a part-time legislature explains why he thinks state government needs an overhaul.
Without question, this is going to be life-changing. It has to be life-changing.
And Michigan musicians serve up new holiday music to help abused and neglected kids all over the state.
Not everybody has the kind of launch pad that many of us had in a warm, loving home. It's a horrendous thing, and it's certainly through no fault of the kids.
Those stories and much more today on Stateside. Welcome to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty, and thank you so much for joining us today. On our program, a major new study finds attitudes about drinking, drugs, and tobacco are changing among teens, and some of these results may surprise you. Then later in the hour, a new group is trying to make Michigan's legislature go part-time. 46 other states have done it, should Michigan. But first, it was October 1st when the healthcare.gov website opened for business. The rocky launch of the public portal to the Affordable Care Act has consumed so much of the nation's attention and news space. But the December 23rd enrollment deadline is now at hand, and we wanted to find out if the consumer experience with healthcare.gov has improved, find out what problems remain, and learn how many of us have been able to complete applications and actually choose a marketplace plan. We're joined by Don Hazart. He's the director of the Michigan Consumers for Healthcare, one of four navigator agencies in our state for the Affordable Care Act. So, Don, compared to where we were back at the beginning of October, is healthcare.gov working better?
Well, if you're someone who's looking for insurance for the first time and creating an account right now at healthcare.gov, it's working tremendously better. If you're an individual who created an account prior to the reboot on December 1st, you're probably still experiencing technical problems. So our statewide network of navigators, we call it Enroll Michigan, and you can go to enrollmichigan.com to find our navigators. They're trying to problem solve with those folks who are still having difficulty who created an account before the December 1st reboot. Obviously, this is not an ideal situation. This isn't what anybody wanted.
Sure.
But anytime you do a major rollout like this, there are going to be technical issues. I don't think we expected technical issues to this level, but thankfully things are improving.
And it seems like there's been a lot of work poured in to make that better. We were looking at the very, very latest figures for Michigan as far as up to the end of November, and we saw there have been 52,780 applications in Michigan covering more than 98,000 individuals. Where does that fit with comparing to the number of applications the government had hoped to have?
Well, you have to keep in mind those numbers that were released, I think, last week represented October and November. Mm-hmm. So those are numbers before they did the relaunch of healthcare.gov. And the problem for someone who's assisting people in getting enrolled, like a navigator, is you need an enrollment tool to get someone enrolled in coverage. And healthcare.gov was our enrollment tool. And it wasn't, as we all know, it's well documented.
Sure.
It wasn't working, certainly not at an ideal level. So that has really been the hold up. So those numbers don't reflect the desire for coverage. Those reflect the determination of those people to overcome all of these technical barriers to get themselves enrolled in coverage. Now, thankfully, going forward, we hopefully will not be experiencing those issues.
And of those 98,235 who've applied, the number of individuals who've selected a marketplace plan in Michigan is 6,847. So that's 7%. And again, going back to the fact that the tool wasn't working.
That's right. It's amazing determination on their part to get themselves enrolled in coverage. And for those people who have been going through that process and trying to work through all these technical problems, they can certainly attest to how problematic it is. Mm-hmm. And certainly navigators can attest to that as well.
And you're expecting that number of that 7% number that existed at the end of November to get a lot higher now that the site's been rebooted and people can actually get through and select a plan.
Absolutely. There's no question about that. Our navigators had a really difficult time prior to December 1st getting anyone enrolled in coverage because, again, their enrollment tool wasn't working. So kudos to those folks that got themselves enrolled, but people going forward shouldn't feel that they can't go to healthcare.gov. It is working very well, especially for someone creating a new account.
We asked some consumers to tell us about their experiences with healthcare.gov, and let's share the first couple of stories, and then I'd like your thoughts and how typical the stories are of Tom and Diane.
My name is Tom. I'm 57 years old. I live in Ann Arbor, Michigan, and previously I was a software support analyst here in Ann Arbor. I've been out of work for a year and a half, and in 2013, I paid for my own insurance for myself and my wife, and it was very expensive with a very high deductible. So my insurance company helped me start the process on healthcare.gov by helping me apply for a subsidy, which I was approved for. Without the subsidy, I wouldn't have been able to afford the policy I wound up with. The process was very easy, answering some simple questions. After I got approved for the subsidy, of course, the website went down. So I wound up finishing the process myself. When I did it online, it seemed so straightforward, I can't understand why people wouldn't do it. The price of the new policy is about half the price of the old policy, and the deductible is about half as well. So I'm in a win-win situation as far as that's concerned.
My name is Diane Kay. I am 33 years old. I'm an attorney, and I live in Brighton, Michigan. I attempted to sign up in October, and it didn't work, but I officially signed up on November 11th. I haven't been insured since 2007. I had a job change and went from working as an attorney for a nonprofit to being self-employed. I have a pre-existing condition, so a lot of insurers wouldn't even cover me as a privately insured person, and other insurers, it was just so expensive. It just wasn't an option. It was terrifying. I was in the hospital for a while and in the ICU overnight, and I'm still paying back tons of debt from that. It was very, very expensive. The process of signing up for insurance through the website was not that bad at all. Once I finally got in November, I was able to get in, create an account, and enter my information and choose a plan, and it took about 20 minutes altogether. It was not very complicated.
So it seems both of these individuals, both Tom and Diane, had that determination that you mentioned, Don, that just, all right, I'm going to keep at this. Mm-hmm. And then once they got through, mm-hmm. enough had been done where they were able to the website where they were able to pretty much finish off and get what they wanted.
Yeah, and I think their reaction is indicative of how people feel about the whole process once the enrollment is complete. Once they have a chance to look at the costs and the value of the coverage, they're very pleased with it. So I remind people, if you wanted to go on the market previously and buy one of these individual insurance plans with the same level of coverage, you couldn't because they didn't exist at any price. So you couldn't buy an individual plan that had these preventative services, covered habilitation, maternity.
Pre-existing condition.
Pre-existing. Like you couldn't buy it at any price. So these are high-quality plans at very affordable cost, especially once you apply all these tax credits and out-of-pocket subsidies that are available through healthcare.gov. So unfortunately, because of all the technical problems at healthcare.gov, that has really clouded all of these great stories of people who are getting quality coverage for a fraction of what they were paying previously. So as we resolve these technical issues, hopefully more and more of these positive stories are going to come out, and we can actually start having a conversation about the quality and cost of the plans rather than this enrollment tool, which should have been irrelevant.
Yes, yes. You thought we would be having that second conversation.
Right. That should have been the conversation all along, not about a website.
I'm speaking with Don Hazard, who's the director of Michigan Consumers for Healthcare, one of four navigator agencies in our state for the Affordable Care Act. We have someone named Sasha who had a somewhat bumpier ride on healthcare.gov. Let's get Sasha's story.
I'm Sasha Acker. I'm 26 years old. I live in Kalamazoo, Michigan, and I'm a social worker. I work part-time at a small, amazing company, but they don't provide insurance. The website is extremely frustrating, infuriating. I was really mad at it for a long time. I called in several times, but eventually I was able to sign up. I was able to pick a plan, and the website still has a lot of problems, but I have insurance, so I'm really happy. I recently tried to go on and pay for my plan, but I couldn't log into my account with my password that I'm certain was right, so I called in about six times, and they told me basically that since they made a bunch of upgrades to the website, some of the accounts got corrupted, and people can't access them anymore, and nobody has a solution for me.
And as Sasha says, I'm really happy I have insurance. If she went on to make a payment and couldn't, she really doesn't have insurance, does she?
Right. Well, she has to make that first payment before January 1st to actually have an insurance policy. So what I would suggest, if she's frustrated with the 1-800 number, and that's what she's referring to when she says she called in, she's calling the 1-800 number, she can locate a navigator in her area, and the navigator can be that intermediary with the website and try to get that resolved. So I would suggest she go to enrollmichigan.com and find a navigator in her area, and that navigator can help her deal with the issues at healthcare.gov.
Enrollmichigan.com. And we did have some reports in the last week that enrollment records for about 15,000 healthcare.gov shoppers never got to the insurance companies that they selected, these 834 transmissions. That has gone down. But are there folks out there, do you think, who feel they have been covered but somehow the word never got to the insurance company?
Yeah, I would suggest they check with their insurance company, whatever provider or insurer that they selected. And we are aware of the problems on the public side. We're not aware of the problems on the insurer side. So we don't even know what issues the insurance companies are experiencing with this, because they don't have to disclose that sort of thing. So what I would suggest is that person call the insurance company directly, say, I signed up. Do you have documentation of that? If there's a problem, they can find a navigator on enrollmichigan.com who'd be happy to try to assist them in figuring that out.
Don, with the December 23rd deadline coming up, that means what, and what do people need to understand about it?
Well, the December 23rd deadline is just if you want a policy that starts January 1st. So the first day these new policies go into effect is January 1st, 2014. It doesn't matter when you sign up, they start January 1st, 2014. And that's what we've been telling people all along. When we experienced those problems with their website when it first rolled out, we were assuring the public, you got plenty of time to sign up, so why don't you wait until they can resolve some of those issues at the website and then sign yourself up. And for those folks that took advantage of that advice and the timeline, they're not really experiencing many problems. They're going on the website right now, creating a new account, and in some cases they can get themselves enrolled in a matter of minutes. For those folks that were early in the process, created a profile, we'll just have to continue to problem solve over at healthcare.gov and get those issues resolved.
What are you looking forward to as you look ahead to 2014?
Well, we're looking forward to a new year where the enrollment tool works, and we can transition the conversation away from a website to the law, the Affordable Care Act. You know, the Affordable Care Act is not an end-all. It's a starting point for healthcare reform. The more reform has to come down the pike. So we need to educate the public what it does and doesn't do, and then continue that conversation in a logical way.
All right. Don Hazard, the director of Michigan Consumers for Healthcare, one of the four navigator agencies in our state for the Affordable Care Act. Don, thank you so much for talking with us today.
Thank you for having me.
Coming up, it's called A Michigan Christmas of Hope. Some of the state's top musicians are hoping their songs will help abused, neglected children all over our state. That story in 10 minutes. You're listening to Stateside from Michigan Radio. This is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. As we heard earlier this week on the show, Michigan is moving ahead with the Common Core state standards for schools. The legislature voted this fall to unfreeze the funding to implement the standards. But not all Michigan teachers are on board. Keith Kindred teaches at East South Lyon High School, and he has this to say.
Just last year, when I brought up the Common Core to my non-educator friends, I would usually see a furrowed brow and a tilted head. That's certainly changed. While administrators may not feel free to say it, I will tell you that most teachers are circumspect about whether the Common Core will lead to positive reform. Our worst fear is that it's simply a part of the continued efforts by some to discredit and dismantle public education. Schools have been under attack for years now, and the failure of No Child Left Behind has educators understandably skeptical about so-called reform efforts. Moreover, the speed with which this is happening makes us very nervous. We're being asked to make wholesale changes in curriculum and instruction methods without meaningful guidance from the state and an incredibly narrow time frame. Most concerning is how little people know about where the Common Core came from and who's behind it. Did you know, for example, that no public school educators were involved in the original construction of the Common Core standards? And when the group who was behind that effort, an interest group called Achieve Incorporated that has close ties to Bill Gates, did seek input from educators, some of those educators refused to approve it until their concerns were addressed. Achieve responded to these concerns by ignoring the educators and moving forward with the project. Additionally, implementation of the Common Core is a potential goldmine for education testing and publishing companies, online education firms, and the like. If you don't think there are private sector concerns pushing for this because of the lure of profits instead of what's best for our kids, you're either willfully ignorant or hopelessly naive. Still, even with these serious concerns, I think it's fair to say most teachers are not opposed to the spirit of the Common Core. These new curriculum standards do indeed require higher-order thinking skills and for students to demonstrate their learning in ways that go beyond traditional standardized tests. In spite of what anti-public school advocates say, we teachers are not obstructionists to true and helpful reforms. But neither are we servile peons who shy away from asking questions that need to be asked. Whether we'll be given the time to implement these changes, whether the state will provide more guidance on how students will be evaluated, whether student results from those tests will be used in a punitive way in a continuing war against teachers and teacher unions, I implore you to educate yourself about the Common Core and to get involved with parent and community groups to monitor its progress. The truth is that politicians and other decision makers don't listen to teachers anymore. I think we're kind of important in the whole education thing, but the public schools and education policy have become hopelessly politicized. It's a sad state of affairs when the people charged with implementing this far-reaching change in education policy don't know what they need to know. We would like some answers to those questions before we rush into this. I would think you would, too.
Keith Kindred teaches social studies at East South Lyon High School. His views are his own and do not necessarily reflect those of Michigan Radio, its management, or its license holder, the University of Michigan. So here we are, 1 week away from Christmas, 2 weeks away from the New Year. Now, of course, the folks who work retail are busy, busy, busy. But many other workplaces are going to see a major thinning of the ranks as we take a holiday break. But how much of a break will we really get? Yes, we may be sitting at home or out of town at grandma's. But there's that great big umbilical cord that connects us with the office, technology. The smartphones, email, iPads, laptops, all of them keep us tethered to work. What's that constant connectivity really doing to us? We're joined for this conversation by Sarita Shainabek. She's an assistant professor at the School of Information at the University of Michigan. Welcome.
Thanks for having me.
Well, it used to be vacation meant vacation, but now that office emails and phone calls can literally follow us to any corner of the earth, is that old idea of a real getaway gone forever?
I think it really depends on when you use technology and how you use it. So if you're bringing your work with you during holidays, that might be a problem. Taking breaks from work is important for your health and for maintaining your social relationships. And so if you don't take breaks during maybe the upcoming holidays, you need to make sure you find times during the year that are meaningful for you where you do disconnect from your technology.
You know, here you are with the School of Information. It is all about information and consuming it. And in doing so, do you think the boundaries between work and home in America, have they been blurred or are they just blown away now? Are they non-existent?
Well, I think they're absolutely blurred. I'm not sure about blown away. It might be getting there. I mean, there are some benefits that you can take your work home with you. So sometimes you don't have to go into the office. You might be able to work while on the road. If you have children, you might be able to balance that better. But at the same time, it does mean that you end up taking it with you on your holidays, on your weekends. And I think it's really hard for people, even people who are experts and who work in the School of Information, for example, to balance your family life with your work life.
And I have to wonder when, with this nonstop flood of information, when someone wakes up and the first thing before her feet hit the floor, she's reaching for the smartphone to check work emails to see what's been happening, maybe even in another part of the world. How does that affect us? What is that doing to our ability to be sharp and our ability to really absorb information?
Studies sort of vary on how much it affects us. Some have said that multitasking is something that we're not actually good at, especially for the people who think that they are good at it. In that case, it might be a struggle to be able to wake up, enjoy your family, enjoy breakfast, while also having work on the mind. For other people, it allows them to schedule their day in a way that they like. Some people are sharpest in the morning. They work best in the first few early hours, and that way might be able to get their mind racing, get them going, and then later in the day they can spend it with their family or relaxing or doing whatever else they want.
So, Sarita, could you give us some ideas, some tips with how to handle technology during our holidays?
Absolutely. I would say that they should establish expectations and talk about them beforehand. So telling family members to get off their devices in front of other family, especially extended family, might be very awkward and tense, and it just makes people retreat more. So if you have a understanding that, say, dinner time is not a technology time, but afterwards we can pull out the cell phones, that lets people know sort of what they're expected to be doing. Another one is focusing on establishing traditions where people can use technology but also be connecting with their family. So it might be playing video games together or watching Netflix movies together. So technology doesn't necessarily have to be stressful or pull you away from your family, but you need to be thoughtful about what you're going to do that sort of allows you to connect with them.
It does seem kind of simplistic to say, put down that smartphone, kind of like Nancy Reagan's Just Say No to Drugs
right.
campaign. What do you do to keep work information from gobbling up your off time?
For me, I love outdoor time. When I go on vacation, I make a pretty concerted effort to decide what work has to get done before then, if I'm going to do any work on the trip. And so I set expectations for myself, and that makes it a lot easier to not do work. If I just decide, well, I'm going to catch up on these things the week I get back, I don't have this pressure sort of riding with me while I'm on vacation that I have to do this thing. So for me and my family as well, I think it's really about managing expectations and communicating about them early so that we have an understanding of what sort of how we're going to spend time together.
We've been talking with Sarita Shanebeck, who's with the School of Information at the University of Michigan. Thanks so much for talking with us.
Thanks for having me.
Well, it is everywhere. Holiday music. You hear it in the car, at the grocery store, at the mall. Jingle Bell Rock, the Holly Jolly Christmases, the ever-present Little Drummer Boys. So in the interest of public service, we thought we'd present a way for you to hear some fresh holiday music performed for a good cause by Michigan artists.
Do you know?
Do you know?
No two snowflakes are alike. Everyone.
That is Devin Scillian with singer-songwriter Jill Jack. Devin is best known as the anchor on WDIV-TV in Detroit, but as you can clearly hear, he is also a singer-songwriter. Devin, welcome to Stateside.
Hey there, thanks. Great to be with you.
And joining Devin is Russ Russell of Holy Cross Children's Services. And the nice thing is that Holy Cross Children's Services, one of the largest private providers of specialized schools and kids services in Michigan, they're getting every penny of money raised from this CD, A Michigan Christmas of Hope. Russ, welcome to the program.
Glad to be here.
So, Devin, we are so familiar with the old holiday standard. Some of us may say too familiar, but this CD really brings a lot of Michigan's best musicians together with new sounds for Christmas.
It's a funny thing. When Russ first got in touch with me about putting together a project, I thought it might be difficult to find a bunch of material. Turns out most singers and songwriters have something waiting around that they've been hanging on to for Christmas for a long time, because we all as songwriters want to take a whack at pretty tried and true terrain, but in a new way. And in the case of some of the songs, I think a new way to say some things about Christmas that haven't been said before.
Such as?
Well, I thought it was really interesting when Jill and I got together. Jill and I have known each other forever, but we'd never written together. We got together, and the whole idea of, you know, the whole matching snowflakes thing that we just started talking about, and no two snowflakes are alike, we both just sort of had this little eureka moment that we'd never seen a song or heard it written about that way.
And Devin, why did you feel drawn to this project that helps Holy Cross Children's Services?
Well, you know, Russ and I've known each other for a long time. We're both Kansans, and so we've been pretty tight over the years. And when he first got to Holy Cross, he and I went out for coffee. I think it took him about 5 minutes to completely sell me on what the mission is at Holy Cross. It really is a really special project and endeavor with a lot of very dedicated people that are trying to help, I think you'd have to say, the least of us. And if there's anything more that Christmas is about than that, I don't know what it is. And so we started to, you know, Russ was wanting to know if I had any thoughts on a way to help out. And I said, well, you know, I've been kicking around the idea of doing a Christmas album, didn't really have any direction to put it in, and before you know it, I think what Russ probably took us, 20 minutes to hatch the idea, and before we knew it, we had lots of musicians on board, and I can't believe how quickly this came together.
Yeah, I mean, this happened very quickly, and but you know, when good things, you know, and for good causes come together, you know, there's always a pathway to getting this thing done.
And over these nearly 70 years, has the need or the kinds of needs changed? Has the mission changed?
You know, the mission hasn't changed. Unfortunately, the need has. And the number of children who live in one-parent or no-parent households is now close to 60% across the nation. And unfortunately, those kids are truly left behind, and they face, you know, incredible hurdles. You know, there's nearly 34,000 kids that were confirmed that were abused or neglected last year, and that's up about 30% from the previous year. You know, it's just really sad what's happening, and I realize that these kids have no voice, and so it's time that we give them a voice. And Devin is actually doing that through his song, but also his commitment to helping us to achieve that.
Now, Cynthia, if it's interesting, if you ask most successful people about the ingredients, the recipe for how they turned out the way they did, almost all of them say, well, I want to credit my parents. You know, I had great parents. And the fact of the matter is, not everybody gets that, and not everybody has the kind of launch pad that many of us had in a warm, loving home. It's a horrendous thing, and it's certainly through no fault of the kids.
Let's take another listen to a clip from this new CD, which is called A Michigan Christmas of Hope. Here is Devin Scillian again, along with actor Jeff Daniels and singer-songwriter Stu Franke. And this song is Wandering Shepherd.
Lay down your trouble, your worries and woe.
You know, there really is such a real array of musicians, names that are very well known in Michigan, as well as styles.
Yeah, I think it's really true. It's funny, if you give the disc a spin, it is kind of all over the place, and that's one of the things I love about it. That's one of the things that I love about the music scene in our state. It really reaches all over the map, and that was one of the really fun things about putting this together. And, in fact, it was one of the really valuable things for Russ and I in getting the Pastorias involved. You know, they called on some people that I don't know that I would have thought to include, and it really sent the disc off in a lot of different directions. But the song we just played is one that I've loved forever. It's an old Dan Fogelberg song, and Stuart and Jeff and I got together and recorded it for a Greenfield Christmas special that we did on Channel 4 years ago.
Mm.
And there's been nothing else to do with that song. I love the way it turned out. It's very, I think, unique, and I think Stuart just sang the heck out of it, and it was just so great to find another place to, you know, to sort of purpose it and to put it.
What do both of you want to see come from this effort, from A Michigan Christmas of Hope?
Well, of course, we want to see people become aware of children that are in incredible, vulnerable positions. And to have the musicians like Stuart Franke and Jeff Daniels and Jill Jack and Karen Newman, of course, Devin and many others, you know, to stand with us and to give these kids a voice. Nelson Mandela said that, you know, a society is really judged by the way in which it cares for its children. And so I truly believe that Michiganders helping Michigan kids will inspire all of Michigan to say, you know, we don't need to be 41st in the nation in how we care for our kids. We need to be the best. And so having the music as an entree to tell the story the way I am today and the way Devin is the beginning of what we believe will end the strife that these kids are in, and that there is a loving, happy home for them in the end.
That was Russ Russell of Holy Cross Children's Services, joined by Devin Skillian of WDIV-TV, who is one of the contributors to this new CD, A Michigan Christmas of Hope. Thanks so much to both of you for joining us.
Cynthia, it's been my pleasure. Thanks.
Thanks so much.
And we wanted to know what your favorite holiday songs are. Here's just a little taste.
I like Fairy Tale of New York by the Pogues and Christy McCall.
The boys of the Amboy Pity Choir were singing, going by. And the bells are ringing out for Christmas Day.
I like the Nightmare Before Christmas soundtrack, if that counts.
And why? They're covering it with tiny little things. They've got electric lights on strings, and there's a smile on everyone. So now correct me if I'm wrong. This looks like fun, this looks like fun. Oh, could it be? I got my wish.
Actually, O Come, O Come, Emmanuel. Any of the a cappella versions I really liked.
Well, if that isn't eclectic, I don't know what is. You guys are cool. Still to come, should the Michigan legislature go part-time? One group says yes. That story in 10 minutes. This is Stateside from Michigan Radio. This is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Let's take a look at vice, teen style. How many of our teens actually smoke, drink, and take drugs? And what kind of drugs and tobacco products are they using when they do? That's what the University of Michigan and the National Institute on Drug Abuse seek to learn in their annual surveys of 40 to 50,000 teens in grades 8, 10, and 12. The latest Monitoring the Future survey was released today. Joining us is the principal investigator. Lloyd Johnston is with the University of Michigan's Institute for Social Research. Welcome.
Well, thank you, Cynthia.
So let's start with tobacco. You're finding teen smoking is continuing to decline?
It is. It's down a great deal since the mid-90s when it reached the peak. And initially, the drops were quite large. They're now smaller, but still important. This year, if we average across the three grades that we study, 8, 10, and 12, we see about a 1 percentage point drop from 10.6 to 9.6% who say that in the past month they've smoked one or more cigarettes. And that's down by large proportion from where it was, 40-50% drop.
Why is it, do you think, fewer teens are smoking cigarettes?
Good question, and I think the answers have differed over time. Price has been a major, price and taxes have been a major factor. But also youngsters changed their attitudes about smoking and smokers a great deal over the life of the study. And now about 80% of the adolescents say they would prefer to date non-smokers.
So get them in the pocketbook and also just the social acceptability of it.
Exactly.
Well, they may not be lighting up tobacco cigarettes, but boy, it sure seems more teens are reaching for a joint. I see 60% of 12th graders don't view marijuana regular use as harmful, yet 36% of those 12th graders saying they smoked marijuana in the last year, just under 30% of the 10th graders, and more than 12% of 8th graders say they used marijuana in the last year. Were you surprised by this, Lloyd?
No, marijuana has been around for a long time and the most popular of the illicit drugs for, I guess, as long as this study's been going on, which is 39 years. But the recent upward movement in marijuana use is also something we thought would likely occur in the context of so much public discussion and passage of legislation to legitimate medical marijuana use, and more recently, actually, to legalize marijuana use in a couple of states.
Right.
And I think that has had the effect of convincing kids that it's not as dangerous to use marijuana as their predecessors thought. And so when we see perceived risk dropping, we very often see use going up.
What about alcohol?
Alcohol has been quite an interesting study. This year, we're seeing the lowest levels of alcohol use among teens that we've seen in the life of the study. It has been a rather steady decrease in alcohol consumption since about the mid-90s. And maybe more importantly, the number of kids who say that they have been engaging in binge drinking or drinking five or more drinks at one sitting in the past 2 weeks. That has been in decline also and is at a low level. It's about 22% among high school seniors who say that they've been drinking that heavily, and I can remember it was 41%.
So what do you think's behind that?
That's a good question. I think that to some degree in the 80s, alcohol lost its panache, and there were a number of campaigns, one from Mothers Against Drunk Driving and another one to encourage people to have designated drivers. And in addition, for the younger kids, there's been a substantial drop in the extent to which they think it's available to them, that they can get it.
So based on what you've found with this latest Monitoring the Future survey, so we're seeing more teens turning away from using alcohol and tobacco, but more teens are turning to marijuana. What should be the takeaway for parents and for policymakers?
Well, I don't want to say that any of them are unimportant. There's still too many teens who are drinking and getting drunk. There's still too many. Any is too many when it comes to cigarettes because the consequences are so dire in the long run. So I think we need to keep the pressure on with both of those drugs. But the marijuana issue is going to be a difficult one. There's a strong division in the country whether it's okay to use marijuana. I think the one area that hasn't been emphasized but which is important is that I think young people themselves are of the opinion that it's not good to be selling to underage people. But the fact is, when we look in the states that have medical marijuana use, we find out a significant proportion of the kids who have used marijuana in the most recent year have gotten it through prescriptions, mostly from other people's prescriptions, roughly 40%. So it's not going to be that easy to separate who gets it in the end.
Lloyd Johnston is with the University of Michigan's Institute for Social Research. He is the principal investigator for the Monitoring the Future survey, which was a joint study by the university and the National Institute on Drug Abuse. Lloyd, thank you so much for sharing your findings with us.
You're very welcome. I enjoyed it.
Should Michigan revert to the kind of legislature originally called for when Michigan voters drafted the first constitution in 1835? A part-time legislature? Well, my next guest says absolutely yes. He's the chairman of the Committee to Restore Michigan's Part-Time Legislature. They're hoping to gather nearly 400,000 voter signatures between January and June and put the question on the November 2014 ballot. Norm Kamerad, welcome to Stateside.
Thank you.
Norm, you're going to start collecting these voter signatures next month. Exactly what are you asking people to sign? What are you proposing?
We are proposing to take Michigan's legislature that has actually been in a full-time legislature since 1963 and bring it back to a part-time, citizen-driven legislature.
And I can see people listening going, all right, that sounds good. So let's get into this a little bit more. Exactly how many days would you see legislators in session under your proposal?
60 days.
When I think about the components of a state legislator's job, certainly there is being in session, there is casting votes, but there is the interim committee work, and there's servicing the constituents, whether you're at the office in Lansing or you're at your district office, and there's also running for re-election. So when would all of that happen if they're only on the job for 60 days out of each year?
Oh, without question, Cynthia, this is going to be life-changing. It has to be life-changing. Trust me. They're going to have to find the time within their personal roles as a citizen of the state to afford for those accommodations. And at the same time, when they're in Lansing, they're not trying or attempting to establish meetings with special interests or sit behind the protection of the governor. They're going to be actually in the district performing these services and also taking our wishes, our needs to Lansing in that 60 days of the year and making it a citizen-driven legislative process.
So we're saying a $35,000 salary. If a constituent needs help with a problem, would they have to wait until that 60-day period rolls around, or would you expect the legislator to be there year-round?
Oh, no. Our proposal actually allows the legislator to have its assistance in Lansing year-round or in the district, however he may find it. And at the same time, the legislator himself will be here with me at Sally's Diner or with you in the district where you can meet him daily, much like your township supervisor. That's the way our forefathers of this state established our earlier constitution, to allow the representative to be citizen-driven, not driven by special interest or cooped up in a building in Lansing for 90 days, quote-unquote, and then be paid over $100,000 and still, when they're passing legislation, to virtually not give us immediate access to its ideals before it's actually proposed.
Norm, would you take those 60 days and have them grouped together or spread through the year?
The proposal we have right now is actually going to allot for that 60 days to occur between the months of January and March.
So if we have a legislature that's only in session from January to March, but the executive branch is there all year round, who's minding the store?
Literally, the legislature will still be in power, even though they're not in Lansing. They're still our legislators, and that portion of the Constitution will not change. What we're attempting to do is make it more citizen-driven, like the 46 other states that have already had this adopted. There's only four states now in the entire United States that actually have full-time legislatures, which are New York, Pennsylvania, Michigan, and California.
But a lot of those states that aren't full-time constitutionally, they're also not limited to that certain amount of session days. They might even meet throughout the year. So I'm still trying to understand, if they're January through March, how are they going to be able to be the watchdogs that we need in Lansing?
Well, it's simple. We are going to keep them in the same authority that they are now jurisdictionally. The governor is not going to step in and start doing the legislature's job for them. In fact, the legislature still will have the authority to approve the budget. They'll still have the authority to also provide the regulations that they do. The difference in this is that now they're going to be in the district with us as they are drafting these bills, and not in Lansing, cooped up in a building where we have limited access to them.
If you've just joined us, I'm speaking with Norm Kamerad. Norm is the chairman of the Committee to Restore Michigan's Part-Time Legislature. They're going to be out starting in January, trying to gather nearly 400,000 voter signatures between January and the beginning of June, hoping to put the question on the November 2014 ballot, calling for the Michigan legislature to be a part-time legislature and be in session only 60 days out of the year. Well, it certainly seems, you know, on the face of it, I think to a lot of people in Michigan, this idea of making this legislature part-time seems like a good thing. We know, both in terms of our lawmakers on Capitol Hill and in Lansing, popularity polls are not very strong for them right now. But I will throw this out. Term limits seemed like a very good idea when voters adopted them in 1992. And there are a lot of people now in the state having thoughtful conversations who believe term limits have hurt the effectiveness of the legislature, so that what looked good on paper didn't play out that way in reality. And I got to wonder, are good high-caliber candidates going to pursue a $35,000-a-year position?
Well, the other 46 states that have adopted some form of legislature have actually found that the caliber of individual that's going to be applying for these same jobs in true public service fashion are teachers, farmers, lawyers. You're going to have all facets that are going to want to actually have the opportunity to serve. The difference is that they're not going to be insulated with an $80,000 a year salary with over 100, you know, combined $100,000 salary and benefits. They're going to have their skin in this game.
Let me just ask you. So let's just say you mentioned a teacher. So let's say I'm a teacher and I want to serve and I run for the legislature. How is my school district going to say, sure, you can check out and be in Lansing January through March? What kind of employer will say, yep, okay, you can check out of this job for that time in Lansing, unless it's an employer who would very much like to exert influence on the legislature?
Well, and understand this. One, $35,000 happens to be the medium salary for just about 80 to 90% of Michiganders. You're talking, for the time that you're there, 60 days worth of work, you're looking at over $17,000 worth of income just for that small time frame you're there. And you might find a teacher that is able to perform that. And then you might find teachers that are saying, well, no, I'm obligated. It could be a substitute teacher. This is something the other 46 states have already found is actually being applied and being applied very well.
If legislators have less time on the job, does that set up a scenario where they'll have to rely more on lobbyists and on groups who are more than happy to provide model legislation? Wouldn't that be turning more and more of our legislative power over to those groups?
Right now, seeing some of the most recent bills that came out, as I had mentioned, they're relying on lobbyists now more so than they are citizen-driven aspects of legislation.
You referenced early on in our conversation saving money. And that's certainly been part of this push for a part-time legislature. And we were kind of trying to crunch some numbers and kind of the cost of the full-time legislature we've seen in the $10 to $12 million range. So let's say going to that 60 days would save about $7 million. When you look at the $48 billion state budget, that's 0.00014%, 0.01% of the whole budget. So like if I was making $48,000 a year, that percentage is about $7 of savings. Should we really relax and cut back on how much time our legislators are in Lansing to save such a tiny amount?
Well, that's actually minuscule given the $8 billion budget deficit that they ran into as recent as 2009 with only a $5 billion income that they were actually trying to work with in 2009 and 10. Cynthia, if you had an $8 billion deficit and only $5 billion worth of income and I was your banker, we'd be talking about possibly trying to stop the bleeding at this point. Now, the savings as far as having the legislators going down in salaries, that's minuscule. And I don't dispute that. The problem is that it is that income that is being received in the manner in which it's received that's actually causing the issue of the billions of dollars of deficit that is being felt throughout the state right now.
Norm, I watched your video on the website for the Committee to Restore Michigan's Part-Time Legislature. And, you know, there it was, the proposal to roll things back to the way that Michigan voters had when the Constitution was drafted, when Michigan became a state, which was in 1837, our population was about 200,000. And last year, the U.S. Census Bureau figures Michigan's population is over 9.8 million. Can what worked in 1837 really be expected to get the job done in 2013?
Well, with the mushrooming of deficit that has taken place since 1963, I'm going to probably say, no, we will have to actually differentiate our proposal, which we have, to help compensate for that. But what we can do is we can actually take our legislature, change its mindset, get its skin in the game, and like the 46 other states that are now successful with their economies, bring this state back to its true greatness. It's going to be hard work. But I feel that once we start taking legislators' minds and making them dependent on the very economy that they're attempting to regulate, we will start seeing things happen here like we have never seen, that our governors that have only dreamed of but never could bring into reality because of the full-time legislative scheme that we've been living under.
Norm Kamerad is the chairman of the Committee to Restore Michigan's Part-Time Legislature. They will be out gathering voter signatures. They need to get nearly 400,000 of those signatures starting in January and going to the beginning of July in order to put the question of the part-time legislature on the November 2014 ballot. Norm, thank you so much for talking with us today on Stateside.
Thank you, Cynthia. It was a privilege.
And in case you missed it, we spoke yesterday with Michigan columnist Dennis Lennox, who is against a part-time legislature. You can find that interview on our website, michiganradio.org. And that's our show for today. Stateside was produced and directed today by Mercedes Mejia. Stateside's executive producer is Zoe Clark. Our engineer today was Peg Watson. Contributors are Ellie Billings, Emily Fox, Renee Gross, Katie Suha, Claire Tennisketter, and John K. Wilson. This program is a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thank you so much for listening. Let's talk tomorrow afternoon at 3 o'clock.